So, Peter, we're here today to talk about Andre Dawson, who is a Hall of Fame Major League Baseball player. He played for 21 years from the mid-70s to the 90s, most notably with the Expos and Cubs. Why are you writing about him now?
Growing up, I was a fan of Andre Dawson's. I respected him, but I was not a super fan, primarily because I was a bitter young Mets fan, and he played for the Expos and the Cubs and did his share of damage in destroying the Mets.
Peter Keating is a senior writer for ESPN.
I don't know if you have anyone like this in your life, but my dad sends me news clippings. Still, he's 85 years old. I got a blurb he sent me from AARP, the magazine, and they had done a page. It's kind of, where are they now? What's going on with anybody interesting who's a senior? And it mentioned that Andre Dawson was running a funeral home. This was long before the pandemic. And then after coronavirus struck, I was trying to think up story ideas. And I remembered that, and I was thinking to myself, like, you know, good Lord, if it was interesting then that this guy could have done anything he wanted to do in his life and decided to run a funeral home, it's probably gotten a lot more intense since then.
After his 20-year baseball career ended, Andre Dawson didn't set out to own and operate his own funeral home. It probably wasn't even on the list of things he might do in retirement. So how did this introverted Hall of Famer end up shepherding his community through grief? Today, a look inside Dawson's unusual journey and what it's like to bury your loved ones and mourn in the age of coronavirus. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Thursday, June 4th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by Marathon. When you first got in touch with Andre, what struck you about him?
The thing that struck me first about him is the first adjective that everybody who knows him uses to describe him, which is the word intense. He was intense as a ball player.
They call him Hawk. In baseball circles, the name commands instant recognition and respect.
His signature look, which isn't why he got the nickname Hawk, but it fits right in, is a kind of furrowed brow. He has this intense stare, even when he's smiling.
Few ever combine all of the skills of the game of baseball. Power, speed, instinct, sheer beauty and grace of action.
And he's just a man of serious purpose. And that made me feel like instantly there's probably some connections between how he played baseball and how he would run a business.
So how did he end up in the funeral business in the first place?
So his brother, who's an attorney in Miami, is part of an investing group that was putting money into funeral homes. But then about 12 years ago, a funeral home near where he goes to church and pretty close to where he grew up in southern Miami was going out of business. And it had trouble with state regulators and it needed cleaning up. And he had a chance to buy it and take it over. So, Andre, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I hear you.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got into this business. It's just surprising for most people to hear about someone who is a baseball superstar who's now running a funeral home.
I started out initially as an investor, and it kind of fell into my lap when we reached a crisis. It seemed that the business would probably look at the potential of being shut down. And I just, you know, took the initiative. My portion of the investment entitled me to ownership.
He knew that it would represent a change in his life to go from a kind of a passive investor to an owner-operator. He has no particular interest in the science of dead bodies or the business of mortuaries. You know, this is not something he had a curiosity about and decided to use his spare time to get involved with. This is something that he talked to local pastors and they said, you have to help us keep this open. So it's kind of become his mission.
Because it had been a business in the community for, about 25 years, I just felt that it was an essential business. And if that's, you know, where I needed to be at that particular time, if it was going to until me taking over ownership to keep it in the community itself, then I knew that was going to be really worth my while.
You know, he doesn't wear his religion on his sleeve, but this is one of the most religion-infused stories I've worked on because Andre prays for guidance.
Prayer has always been a big part of my whole daily routine, how I go about life itself. And that was instilled in me by my grandmother when I was probably high school age. I just continued to ask God for guidance. I realized that, hey, if this is where God placed me, then I know he's got my back. You know, my prayer and my faith is what I'm driven by, and that's what I stand by.
So you asked him not only, you know, why he's in the funeral business, but what his actual day-to-day is like. What is his role there?
He's not particularly front and center with the business. Now, you know, a lot of athletes who have opportunities to go into any kind of business, the whole reason they have that opportunity is to put their name on the business to increase sales. Why did you not want to put your name up front and call this the Andre Dawson or Dawson Funeral Home when that might have been good for business?
I realized that, but I didn't want this to be about me. I said to my staff, this is not about me. It's not about you. It's about a service for the community. I didn't want this to blow up to be something bigger than I had envisioned. For me, the most important things was I want to take on each case with professionalism and quality. And I want to allow myself the proper and appropriate time to make sure that I can allow that to happen.
He kept his name off the business, which had been named for its former owners. He renamed it Paradise Memorial Funeral Home. And he's kind of a jack of all trades in the back office. I asked him what he does day to day, and he started talking about his janitorial duties. He knows how he likes the place arranged, and he figures he may as well do it himself. And he mops, he sweeps, he cleans the offices. He's done everything except embalm bodies. He does not have a license for that, but he's driven a hearse. He's participated in removing bodies from homes to take them either to the funeral home or to a crematorium. What's it like to drive for the first time a car with a coffin inside?
For me, driving it for the first time, I kind of chuckled at it because it was one of my closest friend's mother who had passed, and he wanted to ride in the hearse with me. I told him that I would drive the hearse and I would drive him to the cemetery itself. And I looked back at her and I said, Miss Bruton, I said, I'll try to make this as comfortable a ride as possible for you. And that was my way of just relaxing, knowing that, you know, he was probably a little uneasy over at the other side, but he kind of smiled when I made that comment. And then I know from there, he was a little bit more relaxed.
While it's not called the Andre Dawson Funeral Home, I imagine some of the people who show up do recognize him, right?
He has had people recognize him. He told me a funny story. It's actually funny and touching, where he and his staff were removing a body from a home and encountered a man at the front door of the house who'd been crying.
He looked up, he saw me, and he stopped crying and he stared. And he said, are you who I think you are?
And this is very characteristic of Andre. He kind of gave a little chuckle and said,
who do you think I am? And he flatly said, you're the Hulk. And I said, yes. And he said, wow. And he disappeared on me for about 15, 20 seconds. And he came back with a family photo album. And he showed me a picture that he and I took out at what was Pro Player Stadium at the time when I was in uniform working for the Marlins. And he was about a 12-year-old kid. And that brought a smile on his face. When they meet you, their whole disposition sort of changes. It sort of livens them up. That's why I felt that it was necessary for me to be available as much as possible.
How has his day-to-day been affected by the coronavirus outbreak?
Well, the folks who work in funeral homes or the entire death care industry have to worry about every aspect of this pandemic. First of all, obviously, some of the people passing away who they're dealing with are infected or were infected. And it's still not 100% clear whether corpses can pass the coronavirus. As of the last time we spoke with Andre, his staff had handled 7 coronavirus cases. But I do think even more than that, the whole process of holding a funeral has changed.
By far, it's a lot different from the norm. And you know, families understand they can't do any hugging. And it means so much to a family when they're able to do that. That's something that helps with the process itself. But now, with the understanding that you can't come by, you can't shake an individual's hand. Some of them will wear gloves. They're required to wear masks.
You usually have these folks in for memorial services where they're hugging and close to one another and crying and getting over their grief and gathering in a group to see the person who's died for the last time.
We only require that 10 people come through the doors at one particular time, especially when there's viewings. When a family is having a service, we will accommodate 10 up to 15, as long as they understand it's going to be social distance. When it comes to the visitation, we allow them that viewing time, but under the same principle, only 10 people can come in at a time. The family, you're allowed to stay, but anybody that's visiting, they see the body itself and then they have to leave the premises, and we require them not to re-enter because we want to make sure we get through everyone and get through that process.
I watched one of the live stream funerals that they held, and it is an odd experience because all of the rituals are still there to bring people together. The prayers, the people reminiscing, you know, going up and talking, getting to say goodbye. But every aspect of the Change Memorial Service reinforces how weird and disturbing and I have to say lonely experience it is when you look at the chairs and people are all sitting distanced from one another and nobody can talk or touch. It's noticeable. It affects how people grieve. He's a very one step at a time, one foot in front of the other, determine what the correct thing is to do and then do it type of person. When I said, what's the toughest thing you had to deal with? He told me about dealing with young people who die. And as he put it, young people like to flock, which is, I thought, a great way of saying it. They like to cluster and get together even more than the rest of us, especially at a time of somebody dying before everybody thinks they should have.
Those are the ones that you know you really, you got your work cut out for. You're going to have the onslaught of friends, of classmates. They mourn and grieve a little bit different. They take it very, 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 very hard. It's very difficult for them to grasp what has happened. And I tell my staff all the time, well, we know we're going to have our work cut out for us. You got families greeting each other. You got the kids greeting each other. You got kids outside greeting each other. We got to get the right game face on because there's going to be people coming from every direction.
That has to be kept under control. You can't have that. Shortly after we first talked, you did a service for a young man who was a homicide victim, and it must be profoundly different for you to be doing the memorial service for someone who's 19 years old and has been killed.
It's very tough when a mother has to bury a child. It's kind of like a wound that never heals. It can be a really, really, really sight to see when you got the emotions going on in the way that they are. that's the part of it that's probably the toughest for me, because when you do a service like that, usually at the end of the day, you're pretty beat up and you're pretty drained.
All right, after the break, let's discuss some of the parallels between Andre's baseball career and his new job. We're presented by Marathon. Now, more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. And Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for high-quality, top-tier gas. While we are aware travel might not be top of mind, there might be times where you have to hop in the car to run an errand. Maybe you have to drop off groceries and supplies to your family. Maybe you've become an amazing baker and want to drop off a few dozen cookies on your best friend's porch. Or maybe you just want to drive around to all of your friends' homes simply to wave from a safe distance. But before you head out, remember to fuel up at Marathon. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and reducing emissions. Remember, wherever you need to go, the people at Marathon are behind you all the way. Marathon, fueling the American spirit. So, Peter, as you were interviewing Andre about his new career and how he does his job and how he's doing it right now at such a strange time in history, I imagine his old career was in the backdrop of your mind. We're talking about one of the true greats. How good of a player was Andre Dawson, for those who don't know?
Dawson was an incredible baseball player. When they talk about a five-tool player, I'm not sure that that term is used as much anymore, but back in the day, he had all those tools.
There's a drive, and the left field going back to the wall for safe. It might be hit it! A home run! Holy cow! His 31st home run! His third of the game!
People wonder where he got the nickname Hawk, because he glided around the outfield like a hawk. He looked intense like a hawk. He had a cannon of an arm, which made you think of a swooping hawk. It's actually because when he was young, none of his relatives or friends could throw a fastball by him. And he would just aggressively jump on everything. And it reminded one of his uncles like a hawk snatching prey, I guess. Hawk doing something aggressive. But basically, he could run, he could throw, he could hit for power.
To watch him, he's always hanging in there. Look at this!
Yeah, what a finale for Andre!
What a way to finish a year for the home folks in Chicago! And they're asking for a curtain call as he has just hit number 47. Congratulations all around for Dawson.
Baseball, completely unlike football, you have to measure how much you draw out of your talent every day, because you're playing every day. And fans tend to love the guys who make a show of hustling or crashing into walls. But you know what? Those guys usually end up on the disabled list 50 or 60 days a year. Dawson was in the lineup 150 games a year, despite serious injuries and despite playing really hard.
And Webster's going for three. Here's the throw. He's out. What a throw by Andre Dawson. A heck of a throw to Nail Webster. You're not going to see a much better throw than this anytime, any place. Here it is again.
You mentioned he played through serious injuries. Some of those took place at the very beginning of his career, right?
Even before his serious career. He was playing football in high school, and he dove for a pass. The opposing player smashed into his knee, his left knee. The doctors basically took the cartilage out of his left knee. He played his entire career as a major leaguer, as a Hall of Fame major leaguer, with the knee bones scraping against itself. And he ended up having 15 surgeries and I believe a total of 3 knee replacements.
And yet he was able to overcome all of that.
Yeah, probably the most amazing thing. He talked to me about how the pain was nearly unbearable. He said he was taking 3 Darvocets a game to get through one day's worth of playing. Darvish said it was a synthetic opioid, which was later banned by the FDA. This is powerful stuff. He had to fight off feeling lightheaded because of the medication. About 3 years into his career, he thought about quitting altogether.
I made a comment to my wife. I said, I think I'm a tough guy, but this is unbearable. I can't take it. And I'm considering just giving it up and going home. And she sat me down and she said, please, she said, you don't want to make a decision and do something that you're going to regret later on. I just went out there and I tried to give it my all. And I said, now give the uniform back unless I fall down and I can't get up and they have to come and take it.
Peter, as you considered Andre's new career and how he does his job now, with that knowledge of everything he accomplished in baseball in mind, did you see parallels?
I think he's a very steady, even stoic person. And I think he thinks deeply and at all times of the day. I mean, he keeps notebooks even now the way he did on pitchers. He told me that if he has a thought in the middle of the night, he'll get up, make a note, and then he'll go back to what he calls his visual resources the following day. He thinks through a lot about what his plan should be, how to meet his goals, and then he takes the steps required to meet those goals. He seems a little bit like a man out of time. He's not a baby boomer, even though he was born in those years. So many people wrote he was the last of his kind or the last of his breed or... You know, there'll never be another one like him. And that's not true. You know, in every generation, there's a few of these very intense, hardworking, give no quarter, great teammate type of athletes. He was one of those. But he has an old soul and he has this kind of silent generation virtues of character and sacrifice.
When great athletes retire, they go into a wide variety of fields and jobs. That said, funeral home director is an unusual choice. How did Andre's peers in baseball regard his career move?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I found only one other Hall of Famer who ever went into the funeral business. And there was a pitcher named Wade Hoyt, who was with the 1927 Yankees and who lived it up in 1920s New York. And he actually did, believe it or not, he did vaudeville. And he was known as the Merry Mortician. Well, Andre Dawson is not, whatever he is not a Merry Mortician. And his friends and some of his family would just stare at him. And he told me, you know, he talked to Ricky Henderson, who just kind of gaped at him, and Jim Rice, who said, you're doing what? And that's basically right. It's the reaction any of us would have. I mean, there's a man who could do whatever he wanted with his life, and this is the business he chose to go into. I don't think it's that different than if you or I went home and said, this is what we were going to do. Mm. But it's funny to hear that you know, other baseball superstars had the same reaction.
I understand, Peter, that Andre Dawson, as you've described him to us, is a stoic, quiet person, not the most emotionally expressive guy. But I imagine his line of business can be quite emotional. Did he convey that to you at all?
I came back to the question again and again with him of how do you even learn how to do this? First of all, tactically, like how do you drive a hearse? You need a special license? What's it like to have a body in the car? You know, I had 100 of those questions. But I also meant, how do you learn to cope with loss being your everyday environment? And I think having a built-in reserve and also an aura of competence are two things that help. He also told me that, especially in this time of the epidemic, he started to think of his own personal time as quarantine time. And I think that term would apply to the time that he takes every day to kind of recharge himself, even if there weren't a pandemic. How do you recharge?
I usually like to take a nap right at the end of a big service. I have an office where I get on the recliner, recline bike, close my eyes. If I have the television on, I'll turn it down real low and try to take about a 2-hour nap. I try and isolate myself and have a period where I'm just alone. That's what I call my quarantine moment.
Did you get the sense that he loves this job?
I did. And at the very end of the last time we talked, he said something that either I hadn't drawn out of him before or that he wanted to emphasize.
There's no tough guy in this business. On the baseball field, the game humbled me. Well, this humbles you even more because the crowd isn't roaring or cheering. And you see the sensitive and the emotional side of you. I didn't know that, you know, I could be put in a position where things could touch me so much. And that's what losing a loved one can do. It touches you. It shows you the reality of what love and life means to people and their lives. I can honestly say I never would have thought this is where I would spend the last half of my life when I wanted to enjoy the golden years after retirement. But it is what it is, and you know, I've got to the point now where I wouldn't trade it.
I wouldn't trade it for anything. That's actually what he said.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Mina, it's always a pleasure.
Coming up, a former big leaguer offers his thoughts on the way forward following the killing of George Floyd. Hi, guys. Given everything that is happening in the world right now, most of us are buying things online. I saw that AT&T started doing two really helpful things for those who want to buy a new phone or device online. They are offering fast, free, non-contact delivery and curbside pickup so that online shopping is as simple and safe as possible. On top of that, they have a flexible return policy so you can shop at ease. You can visit att.com to learn how to shop online from the safety of your home 24/7. Subject to change, restrictions apply. Here's another story I want you to know. As the nation continues to grapple with the fallout from the killing of George Floyd and others, we've been gathering some thoughts and perspectives from across the world of sports on the significance of this moment. Doug Glanville played 9 seasons in the majors for the Phillies, Cubs, and Rangers. He's now a baseball analyst for ESPN, as well as an adjunct professor at the University of Connecticut, where he teaches a class on the role of sports, race, and media in society. He put together these thoughts on George Floyd, the aftermath of his death, and the potential for change moving forward.
It takes 8 minutes and 20 seconds for sunlight to reach the earth. In that time, under its warm touch, the world saw George Floyd go cold under the bended knee of injustice and inhumanity. We stopped, still granted the gift to breathe, trying not to stare, but unable to look away. Then the tears flowed and the temperature rose. The glistening streets became thoroughfares of protest until buildings burned under the recklessness of justifiable outrage and hopelessness. Nothing had changed. We had once again ignored the disinfecting power of the sun. We had silenced the voices of a people because their peaceful pleas were not made at the right time, at the right place, in the right way. We were told once again to wait, even when Martin Luther King Jr. implored us in his letter from a Birmingham jail, that wait has almost always meant never. And the face of smug indifference casted its shadow, with self-serving and willful ignorance, defiantly staring into the heart of the sun until we were all blinded by the hate. Staring with eyes that could see color, but not humanity. Yet the sun rose again, to give us another opportunity to be enlightened, to help us see George Floyd as all of us and not just one of them. 8 minutes and 20 seconds to see that we are all still breathing. Enough time to lift a knee, enough time to say something, enough time to take a deep breath, enough time to not send that tweet, enough time to ask why I'm calling 911, enough time to wipe a tear, enough time to change a heart, enough time to be a teammate, enough time to listen, enough time to break bread, enough time to learn from our differences, enough time to raise a flag, enough time to pay our respects, enough time to love a country, enough time to say enough. Enough. We have had enough time to change, but this time, too many times, the light did not illuminate because we shielded our eyes from the reflection that we did not want to see. We are 8 minutes and 20 seconds too late. And George Floyd is eternally non-responsive because we were non-responsive. So let's respond and make his death be our light.
I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.